The State Department of Consumer Protection from the Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection has tallied the complaints it received from consumers last year. And I guess one surprise is how creative these would-be scammers continue to be. I bet my guest will agree with that, Michelle Ryan. And Michelle is administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, back with us to answer your consumer questions. And we're going to talk about the top 10 complaints that were raised with consumers over the last year. That list just came out today. And I hope you'll join in. If you have a question or maybe an experience to share, want to know what's going on, give a call. The number 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michelle Ryan, good to have you back.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always an enjoyable time when I'm here.
But we're not always talking about the most enjoyable things. We've got a lot of complaints that come into your office every year, and each year you release a summary of the top 10 categories, and we'll talk about them and some other things as well. But why, and I imagine you're doing this, well, maybe I should just ask you, why do you do it? I'm sure in part it's to call attention.
Absolutely. We want to call attention to the issues. We also use this to analyze where we're putting our resources, our education efforts, to be sure that we are hitting the issues that consumers are encountering most frequently. And we really pay attention to what's on the bubble as well, what's ready
what's
to creep
up.
In to be sure that we are ready for what's coming and navigating that. And when I say resources, it's not just the outreach, but that mediation, the investigations that go with it. And when we get inquiries about regulations, are they appropriate for the circumstances and the things we're seeing? Because things change over time. Mm-hmm. The basics stay the same, but things certainly go through a roller coaster. And is it the same thing year after year, or do we see new things pop into a situation?
And as I was looking at the list, some things go up and some things go down a little bit. Now, one that stays pretty high, though, and is number one, was landlord-tenant disputes, which is by far the biggest category.
It is by far the biggest category. And if you'd asked me this 3-4 years ago, it would be a significant category, and it was number one, but it wasn't by far the biggest. I mean, compared to its number two companion, telemarketing. We used to come in here 5 years ago, and telemarketing had 4,600 complaints, and it was increasing every year for 20 years. And in 2022, landlord-tenant became the number one issue, and it's been growing every year, 2,620 complaints, landlord-tenant issues. Some of that spike this last year, an increase of 95 complaints, is related to the floods that we had around the state. We had tenants not sure how to navigate that situation.
I'm thinking as an example.
Landlord responsiveness, what do I do? It was quite an experience for homeowners, let alone tenants who didn't then own that property. What could they do to remediate the situation and get back into a property, or where did they go? And they still had a rental agreement. But
what's your role then as a, not maybe yours specifically?
Yeah, the bureaus.
You and the bureau.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, the issues around this category are failing to maintain the premise, security deposit returns, eviction, unauthorized entry, mold, infestation, inadequate disclosures, unsatisfactory service. So now we get a complaint about those things. What do? We reach out to the landlord. There are regulations in the state of Wisconsin that govern landlord-tenant relationships, and we analyze that complaint to see if those are being followed. We contact the landlord about every complaint in trying to help mediate the situation for the individual consumer. At the same time, the team is looking at the complaint to say, is this landlord being compliant? Are they following the law? Do we need to look at compliance actions or enforcement, or do we need to investigate? Is there a pattern and a trend? And for landlord-tenant issues, that pattern and trend can take longer to develop because those relationships are longer. And some landlords only own a handful of properties, so we're only going to see it come up every year or so versus shopping online every day. We can get contacted about a business there. So certainly we are trying to mediate and then enforce the laws as a whole. I do want to say in this category as well, more than 5,000 contacts to our consumer protection hotline with questions from both tenants and landlords. That's a quarter of the total contacts that we received about this one issue. So it's a huge driver of our time. And it's a really emotional category because this is where someone goes to rest, rejuvenate, raise their family, interact and engage and celebrate. But at the same time, it could be a single person's investment if they're, you know, what we sometimes refer to as a mom and pop landlord versus a big corporate landlord. And so and it's a long-term relationship because you're usually there for an extended period of time. So it can get very emotional and communications can break down quite a bit.
So landlord-tenant, you mentioned telemarketing, and I that came up number two, I think you inferred there.
Yeah, 1,283 complaints. Every time we're here talking with you, it's these issues, the phishing and spoofing, that misrepresentation of the caller ID, people trying to get you to respond to a text message or a phone call and give away your personal information, imposter scams, robocalls, harassment. And then it's the do not call list. Those individuals who've signed up and said, I don't want to receive a telephone solicitation, and telemarketers either not registering to get that list or not honoring those individuals who are on the list. We follow up with those cases. We take those enforcement actions. We get that compliance. So it's both categories. You know, only 1,200 complaints down from that 4,600. There's been a lot of technology changes. There's a lot of task force. We know it's still happening. So those complaints are down. The contacts to the hotline, nearly 1,500. So we know a lot more activities happening in our state than people are complaining about, because I think part of it is they're just not answering and they're hanging up as well. So we're not getting those reports, which, hey, that's great if they're not being taken advantage of. That's what we want. But we need to know as well.
For a long time, you've been telling people, don't even pick up.
That's right. So I applaud every single one of them.
Well, and talking about phone service providers, issues with phone service providers and I guess mechanics?
Telecommunications is that phone service provider, 633, up about 100 complaints from last year. So it moved spots. It's the fourth spot. Billing disputes, because that's your telephone, it's your cable, your satellite, your internet service provider, that bundled package of all of that telecommunications situations. We actually had a case last year. We were able to settle for $450,000 with a telecommunications provider that had misrepresented the monthly price of their internet service to consumers. So a lot of work went into that category over this last year.
So what's next?
Well, in fifth, we have identity theft, 468, but that's down about 150 complaints. I always feel like that's the category that the number never represents what's going on. From the phone calls we get on this program about people identifying and identity theft, you don't know what's happening until you know it's happening. You know, it could be going on for people. We heard a lot from consumers about online accounts, takeovers on their social media platforms and their financial accounts. This is that space where we really hope everyone's doing everything they can to prevent it by changing their passwords regularly, putting those security freezes in place, having fraud alerts so you get notified and responding quickly.
One that came up for the first time in the top 10 was surprised me in a way was major appliances.
Yeah, 158 complaints. You see a huge difference in the number from 1 to 10 here. But this was new because we had a spike here in the fall of complaints when a relevant business in Wisconsin closed its doors on very short notice, and it left consumers who had made purchases of major appliances sitting there with questions and concerns, no product being delivered, and no refunds. You know, hands up, what do you do? Where do I go? And Consumer Protection, we're there to try and help resolve that. It's an ongoing situation. We also saw the regular complaints of defective products, billing disputes, refunds, warranty issues happening. But that spike, that's what drove it to the top 10 this year.
And here we are in the tax season. I know taxes came up. It's, you know, scammers, what are they trying to do?
Yeah, we have two things we want to bring to attention, and that's the back tax scams and then those tax preparation tips so you can avoid scams this month. And scammers, they're calling consumers. They're claiming that they owe back taxes. They're saying that they are representatives from fake companies or organizations with names like Tax Resolution Oversight Department or Tax Mediation and Resolution Agency. And they state that the consumer's not paid their taxes. They offer to help, of course. Then they ask for personal information and upfront payments. Mm. And that can result in consumers losing their money and compromising their identity. And they're losing money that they might need for this year's taxes. You know, who knows? Uh-huh. Because they're just giving a lot of pressure to individuals. And they're saying they're limited time offers. This will be their only attempt to reach you. So if you receive a call from someone who says they're the tax resolution officer and they want to perform a red flag check or help with an IRS liability reduction program, these are all those key phrases that need to be the warning signs that this is a scam. If you think you owe any back taxes at all, just reach out to the IRS. They're not making cold calls, and neither is Department of Revenue. So you can reach out directly to either one of those agencies to inquire what your tax situation is. You don't need to wait to be called.
I was thinking back to my own taxes a few years back. I forget what I did. I screwed up. Anyway, I had underpaid my taxes, mm-hmm. And so I got contacted directly from the IRS saying, you owe the money, but it was in a letter.
Exactly. It's a letter. And the letter even has like a form number on it.
Yeah.
And so you can go online and verify that this is the form of, you know, you didn't pay enough underpayment penalty.
Darn. I wound up having to pay a little fine for that too. You know, you get charged interest. I have not made that mistake since. You only want to do that once.
Right.
You learn your lesson, but I got an official letter from the IRS. They didn't call me up and say, hey, Larry.
Right. And then if you took that letter and said, I don't know, is this a scam?
Yeah.
Do I really
want
to do that? You could go then online and you can go to irs.gov, compare the form number. You can also just compare the contact information. Is this really the contact information? Is this legit? Okay, no, I can follow up and call because I don't believe I underpaid. And, you know, make your argument there. There'll be the appeals process. There's formal processes. There's urgency to pay so the interest doesn't continue to accumulate, but it's legitimate and you can follow with that. But the other thing that we're seeing is those tax preparation tips or tax preparation schemes that are out there as well.
Yeah.
You know, there's this thing that we're referring to as ghost tax preparers. We want people to avoid this. This is someone who prepares tax returns without proper certification. So an individual who professionally prepares federal tax returns, they have to have a valid 2026 prepare tax identification number, and you can confirm that online. But they try and trick you into getting around this certification. These ghost tax preparers don't sign the returns that they file, so therefore they wouldn't need to have this. Instead, they try and convince you to sign the documents, which makes it appear as though you're filing themselves, you've prepared them yourselves.
And you did all the work.
And yeah. And so that makes the tax preparer liable for any mistakes. That's you now instead of the preparer. These preparers move very quickly from area to area. They promise to provide really big refunds. They offer other benefits to just try and solicit that business. So avoid those act now situations that are really just too good to be true.
Michelle Reinen, our guest today, administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, talking with her about consumer scams. And if you have a question or comment, maybe you've got an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. We'll give you a chance right now. Give a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at consumer protection and consumer scams with Michelle Reinen, administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. She's been coming by. We've been talking for a long, long time, 17 years or thereabouts, I think it's been. So it's always great to have her come along. You know, I'm going to skip out of order once because I drove to Kansas to see my daughter at Christmas time. And you go through the tolls down there, you get billed after the fact. And I knew about this text scam business. Mm-hmm. I actually got a letter from them, and I was able to check to make sure it was actually the folks who were legitimately owed money before I sent it in. But there have been text messages coming in that.
Yeah, there have been. We got hit really, really hard with this last spring, around spring break. I mean, I was in a room and every single one of us got the text within a minute of each other. I mean, based on what service you had. But we've heard from consumers again already this year that this has started to circulate. And we really want to get the word out because before you know it, we will have spring break here.
Yeah,
and people will be traveling. And, of course, they've come off the holiday travels as well. And these text messages are targeting Wisconsin because we are not a toll state. And so we might not have familiarity as to how it works. But they indicate that they are a final notice message that claim that they're associated with our Wisconsin DOT. It says WISDOT, WISDOT. They include a link to pay outstanding balances right away to avoid penalties and legal actions. But if this is open, that link leads to this website, which appears to be a toll payment portal. So it looks legitimate, but it's controlled by the scammer. It's not legitimate. We don't have tolls here in Wisconsin. And we have some neighboring states that have them. Maybe you will have taken your vehicle and traveled and crossed through an area, but you don't get a text message. There's no magic reader that says, okay, this is the cell phone in the car and I know who to text. You get a letter that usually it's associated with your license plate. And if you've rented a vehicle, then they go back through the rental records to figure it out. And that's how you know to pay. If you don't keep track yourself and then go initiate the payment on your own, because that's the other method. You drive through, you're told you have 7 days, go online, make your payment. But I've seen this letter as well because my father and I have traveled and he called me. I got this letter. I thought we paid this. And I was like, no, pay. This is okay. This is one you can pay. Because, again, it was the letter and we hadn't made payment yet.
James in the town of Arena has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, James.
Good morning. See, I just caught this at the perfect time. I was able to call. I formerly was an owner-operator of a large truck, a quad-axle dump truck. So I was registered with State of Wisconsin, of course, the USDOT, as a licensed carrier, and I had a USDOT number. Now, it's been 10 years since I've operated the truck, and I haven't looked back yet. I thought I did all the proper paperwork to finalize my business, and lately I've been getting texts that claim they're from the USDOT, and I'm not in compliance because I haven't filled something out, And, of course, fines can be up to this much if you don't comply, and then, of course, they give you a link to respond to.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have heard and seen these messages come in this realm as well with the business owners in the large truck capacity area. So I would encourage you to file a complaint with Consumer Protection so we can continue to look at this matter with our state and federal partners. It also helps then, you know, to validate and verify you have done everything, that you're all confirmed there. You can reach our Consumer Protection hotline at 800-422-7128. Or you can go to our website just to file the complaint directly at datcp.wi.gov. But James, I really hope that you would, you know, take a screenshot of that message if you can and put that in with your complaint.
James, there you go. In the meantime, don't be going clicking on it, whatever they want to send you, for sure. Lois in Madison, your turn. Hi, Lois.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A couple weeks ago, my husband got a phone call asking him if he knew that he was being fined for not reporting for jury duty. He hadn't been asked to do any jury duty, and neither had I. They also had my phone number, and when he hung up, they called me. They called several times, and then they told us that if he didn't pay over $4,000, within 7 minutes, marshals were going to be at our door to arrest both of us.
Wow.
Man.
That's a lot.
That's scary. You know darn well it's a scam.
Yes.
Well, yeah, it took my husband off guard because he hasn't ever received a call like this. So he was kind of panicked. We called our neighbor who was working from home just to watch out for us. And then we called my sister-in-law, too, just, you know, in case something happened, in case somebody did try to come to our home with masks or whatever. And, of course, it was a scam, and we hung up. But it really took us, you know, a few minutes to figure it out.
Right. Yeah. I'm really glad you raised that point. It's an emotional, it's taxing emotionally because it you get that responsiveness, and they're trying to play on that fear that they're putting in place. $4,000 is a lot of money, too, for a penalty in that situation. So I'm glad things worked out. This absolutely is a scam. Jury duty doesn't call and demand payment. Law enforcement won't call and say you've missed jury duty. Each municipality or county is a little different as to how jury duty works, but the basics is you get your letter and your assignment time. And then you have to call in to see if you have to report and if you have to report. But there are options for if you can't make it, usually. But you can call your county clerk of courts to find out. If you've ever concerned that you've missed jury duty, you get this call. And have I? Hang up. Call. Call your municipality. Call your clerk of courts and find out. Did I miss jury duty? I'm pretty sure this is a scam, but now I just want to make sure I'm in the right here type situation because there's different processes if you miss it as well.
Yeah. And Lois, thanks a lot for calling because this is probably something, and we may not have talked about this today during the show, and so you bringing it up will help all these other folks who are listening in today to, if they get something like that, to follow Michelle's advice and hang up on them. And thank you again. Helen in New Glarus, your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Excuse me. I have a couple things that are probably small, but I think they affect a lot of people, and they have to do with grocery stores. One of them is I've noticed a new kind of pricing where they will have a big sign saying two for $8. But then when you get to checkout, if you buy one, it's like $5.99 or something. So it's not half of H to buy one. They encourage you to purchase probably more than you want at some point. That's number one. And number two is, and maybe this can't be helped, but there's no prices on a lot of things. So you have to wait till you get to checkout to find out if you can afford the premium apples or potatoes or something. And I don't know if there's a rule about that. But anyway, those are my complaints.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Michelle, what have you got?
Yeah, this issue crosses over into both the Bureau of Consumer Protection and the Bureau of Weights and Measures at DADCAP. And the first item, the two for eight type situation, that can cross many different paths and be looked at. But if there is clear advertising that indicates two items for this price, then that's what it is. Oftentimes, you may see an undersign that'll say one equals $5.99 or whatever that may be. But they need to honor what they represent. It doesn't say that if you buy one, you're going to get half. Sometimes that I've seen as a rewards program option. Versus just every customer in the store option. So you really have to look at what it is they're representing and saying versus the shelf price. And then there is no requirement that items have prices. The requirement is that the store honor the lowest advertised price of a particular item. So if there is a shelf price and there's no ad, that needs to be what you get at checkout. But there isn't anything that says every item has to be priced regulation-wise. So we are hearing more and more about this from consumers.
And Helen, I had kind of the opposite experience in a way, because there was something marked, let's say, two for $8. So I thought, I really don't need two of these. I'm just going to get one. And the one was $4. So in this case, they were, you know, the goal was to buy two.
Yeah, they're still trying to get you to buy more.
They're still trying to get you to buy more. and so, yeah, so it can kind of work both ways. But your way is far worse than what I was just talking about. Thank you very much for calling. And by the way, you can join in too. Questions or comments will get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Will in Stone Lake. Will, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me on. This is an IRS question, and maybe it's not a fair question, but I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. Last December, my grandson received $1,400 from the federal government, and my best recollection is that it was something to do with COVID that he had, you know, this mm-hmm. is 2 or 3 years ago, but the check was sent December 2024. 3 months later, we get a letter from the IRS saying, because of a processing error, if you haven't cashed the check, send the check back. If not, you owe us $1,400. My question is, I called up our guy that helps us with the tax business, and he said that don't do anything, just kind of wait it out. Well, I haven't gone back to the accountant, and I haven't gotten another letter from the IRS. So I'm wondering, have you heard of anything like this
happening?
I have not heard of this happening. I would be cautious as to where you'd be sending a check written to you if you haven't validated that it is legitimate with that entity, using information outside that letter, because it could be a scammer trying to get you to direct that to them, that check to them that hasn't been. But at the same time, could this be legitimate? Part of me says, I guess, yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know IRS particulars that way, so I'd go to irs.gov and take a look to see if this scenario is listed in any way, shape, or form on their website. And if you have, can reach out to a contact number to inquire with them if the letter you've received is legitimate and what it is that you need to do and what's going on.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Well, thank you very much for calling. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to say people should compare scams and real offers. Limited supply and time offers might be legitimate, but pressure intensifies emotions unnecessarily. When responding to legitimate offers, it's vital to obtain and maintain enough genuine supplies to avoid desperation. Not quite sure. Anyway, scams and real offers. Oftentimes, the scams are either they're offering you a huger amount than you think is, or they're offering you something that is far cheaper.
Yeah, or immediate.
Immediate.
It's act now or you lose it. There isn't a time period to analyze, think, and evaluate what your needs are. And I think, you know, what Dennis is alluding to somewhat is the psychology of a scam.
Yes.
And that is that I'm no brain scientist at all, but I've certainly heard lots of things of they're trying to get you into that part of your brain where you are just responding and not thinking through all the things. The roller coaster part of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
I think they make you amygdala, I can't say it now, but where that you again, it's the heightened emotion response, and so fear, urgency, intimidation, threats, immediate action, all part of that psychology of a scam.
Mary in Portage emailed to say she has an account with U.S. Cellular for two phone lines. She said U.S. Cellular sends her one bill. One of the phone lines is Mary's. The other is for her disabled sister-in-law who died a month ago. Mary has tried to cancel the second line, but continues to be billed for it. Customer service told Mary they never prorate a bill. She argued with them that they should discount for non-service. They did take $25 off of a $117 bill. But the issue here is, it sounds like, if someone's died, her sister-in-law died and was on somehow on her line, and they're not taking them.
Right. This is one of those situations where, you know, I'm curious what the plan is to begin with. If it was just a combination, if we're still on a kind of contract length, but yes, someone has passed. So what does the contract say about that aspect of it? I would encourage, given the interactions you've already had, based on what I'm hearing, that you file a complaint with Consumer Protection. These are the types of issues that that telecommunications category is about. These billing disputes, these cancellation denials and refund aspects. And we can help try and get to the bottom of some of that and also see that any representations are properly being honored by the company as it relates to what's in your agreement. So you can reach out to the Consumer Protection Hotline at 800-422-7128 or go to our website at datcp.wi.gov. Fill out that complaint and let us try and help in this situation.
Yeah, you could be a big help in this situation. Again, 800-422-7128 or online at datcp.wi.gov. There you go. Mary, and good luck. Appreciate your email. Sherry in La Crosse, what's on your mind?
Hi. So a friend of mine, an older adult, gets these flyers in the mail for the new cure-all that's going to solve all their pain and joint issues. And one bottle is a mere $60, but with this card, you can get 20% off. But you can also get a discount if you get two bottles, and three bottles were $120. So $100 for the snake oil, and I'm frustrated by the math, and I'm frustrated by these snake oil salesmen. They're selling cure-alls to all these people with their aches and pains, and I know that's FDA, that's not you guys, but I mean, it's, yeah. Ads that you see on TV and online, you know, Dr. Oz backs this up, Dr. Phil backs this one up, and and stuff like that. I feel really bad for these people that you know, they got bottles of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look at those sensational claims, that magnificent pricing and reduction. It's that evaluation of those claims and what this really does, what science is behind this. I know Sherry mentioned the FDA, but if they aren't claiming that this is a drug and this is just something else, it may not be reviewed by the FDA.
Correct.
And so it isn't actually. It's just, I don't know what the product is. She didn't name one, but she used the term snake oil. I mean, that is the old 1890s consumer protection of the cure-alls that are out there and need that evaluation. And so it's important to really look closely at reviews, to look at organizations that evaluate these types of pills or supplements or whatever this may be out there, to see if anyone's done any studies or evaluations before you go investing this money. And, you know, when you're starting to take something, it's often important to talk to your medical professional as well, because whatever this is made up of could have an impact on other things that you're taking as well.
Yeah. I looked into one of those because I have some family history of others within the family with Alzheimer's, and there's one with Alzheimer's. And so I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go through all of the, I went down that rabbit hole, and I never, all I got were individual, well, this really cured, I can now remember everything when I couldn't remember anything, but there were no data.
Yeah. And so how is that person basing it? Did they also start eating healthier, or were they, you know, sleeping better for other reasons? It's so much that can go into it. And were they real reviews, or they made up reviews, only positive reviews, no negative comments? And now we have artificial intelligence factoring in too. It's become more difficult to evaluate things. So sometimes you just need to look at the pricing structure and the sensationalization of an ad.
Michelle Reinen, our guest, administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us here today on WPR News. Coming up at 12:30 today, you know, about 10% of the people of Wisconsin, in Wisconsin, have a student loan. And about 10% of that number are in arrears on their loans. And so we're going to talk with our guest from the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt about that situation and try to clear up the confusion that is existing around the payments themselves and what you can do about it if you're one of those folks with a loan, or maybe you're in arrears on it. So we'll deal with that at 12:30. Right now, consumer complaints on the docket with Michelle Reinen, of our administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. And we'll go back to the phones. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Nick in Green Bay, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
All I can say is, So, I don't know. It started about a month or two ago. I've been getting these phone calls saying that I have this money from the government sitting in an account. And, you know, they're trying to get a hold of me. And it was, like, just continuous. So I called AT&T. AT&T told me to download this ActiveArmor app. And it actually did pretty good. It catches about 50% of the phone calls. And so I'm wondering what I can do. I've never signed up for anything. I think it's just they're going through phone numbers and just calling random people. But I seem to be the lucky one that gets a lot of phone calls.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm sorry that you are one of the lucky ones. It's random dialing. You're absolutely right. It can be the auto dialers that are out there. It could be depending upon how long you've had your number, the person who had it before you, before portability, may have engaged, and that number could be on particular lists in some way, that it's more frequently dialed as well, or that it has an area code that they're hitting heavier than others. I think it's great that you downloaded an app that's helping to minimize that, and you've communicated with your telecommunications provider. Just encourage you to continue to not answer the phone, and if you do, not clicking the buttons or link when they tell you to get off lists and things, because that just, again, indicates to them engagement and ups the value of contacting you. And some just get into these harassing modes where they just persist and persist, persist.
Yeah. And in one case I know of, the person got a check and had received a check for, apparently it was somebody who, his wife had died and had had property, and so this was going to be found property.
Mm.
So cashed the check, but then they wanted a bill of $700 for finding, as a finder's fee. But in that case, the check was cashed. And what happens then is, what, a couple of weeks later, it's...
Yeah, it could be the fake check. And so you've cashed it. You think you have money in your account, but you don't have any money in your account at all. And if they've asked you with that finder's fee to pay the $700, mm-hmm. and you've done that, you've now just given your money because you didn't get the original true value of the check, because it was all just that fake check and a scam.
If you cashed a check like that, would it be somehow they could get find out where your account was or something like that?
Since it's all just a fake check and it's not tied to their account and routing, my gut says no, because there's no process back. They're not, it wasn't really a check that's routing back to a true account.
I see.
For us to then trace that. It's all just made up. It's real information all compiled together to make up a fake looking something. That's why it's harder for banks to recognize these things until they've been completely processed. And we need to wait a significant amount of time if we ever cash these checks to see if the money is really there and stays there, that the check is legitimate.
Mary in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I was not exactly a victim, but I want to be I want to caution people, because it's vacation rental time now. People are looking out on websites for vacation rentals. And last summer, I received a letter from a person in Green Bay that said they had rented our vacation rental, which I do have one, but I don't rent it directly. I go through a management company that does it for me. And they rent through Airbnb, VRBO, and their website, Vicasa. Anyway, he sent along documents, and he said that he had paid $3,000 and that the person that was handling our estate on our behalf was requesting the payment early. And he thought that was odd, because it wasn't until it was supposed to be paid the week before 4th of July. So he didn't have our name or address, because it's not attached to the account. So he contacted the county sheriff's department where our rental is located. And they informed him of our name and address, so that's how he got it. And he said, they told me to contact you to see if you are legit and if this person is operating on your behalf. And I said, no, they are not. I've never heard of that person anywhere. And he sent me pictures of the website. It was a website that's used on Facebook for Wisconsin rentals, vacation rentals. It had pictures of our property that were copied and pasted off of VRBO. And it had all the information. He even sent me the contract that he was sent, which looked very legitimate. It looked like a totally appropriate contract. He had paid the money. He had paid the $3,000, but thought this was suspicious. So I called the sheriff's department, and before I did anything with this gentleman that contacted me by paper letter, I called the sheriff's department, and they said, yes, they had been in communication with him, and they wanted me to be aware that this is a problem in the county. And, in fact, they've had two properties recently sold by individuals, purchased by other parties, that were totally fraudulent. So the true owner of the property had to go through lawyers to get it reversed, and the people who bought the properties, which were not cheap properties, one was over $300,000, were out their full purchase price. So the sheriff's department said, you really need to be aware as an owner, you need to set up some alerts on your accounts. So I reached out to the rental company I work with, and they had not had anything like this happen, but they were familiar with scams like this. I reached out to the Facebook page that this was posted on, and they said they warn people all the time to make sure to check. But yet, this one looks so legitimate. I said to I eventually called the gentleman that had sent me the letter, and I said, no, it's not me. This was a scam, and I'm so sad that you had to go through this. But there's nothing I could do. There was no insurance. There was no nothing that could cover it. I wasn't exactly the victim because I didn't have any loss, but our reputation might have been tarnished a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Marion, that way you are a victim in that your reputation could be damaged, and you could end up having a lot of people contacting you because they rented a property from you, but they didn't. It's this person in the middle. This is a scam that we usually warn consumers about that are looking for the vacation rental, that they verify that the rental they are seeking is legitimate, and it's not a scammer having lifted photos off of legitimate platforms and pretending to be the owner or the management company for it. So you explained it perfectly from the reverse side, being the homeowner. And we've certainly seen this creep into actual residential rentals where a landlord has been impersonated and an individual rented the property, actually had building problems with it, kept trying to contact the landlord, no response, and finally the ceiling fell in because it was a water damage situation. Well, they then had to leave because the property was condemned until it could be repaired. The landlord now finds out what someone's in my property, and I didn't rent to them. You know, they're money in the middle. So you need to verify. We really strongly urge people to use verified platforms that have guarantees, follow-through connections, escrowed money that isn't going directly to the person until you receive the product, as opposed to open platforms where it's harder to verify and imposters can get out there.
Oh, boy. Mary, I thank you very much for relating that story. It's good news. It's good information. Let's put it that way. Good information to have. And now we're finding out from both the owner of a potential property and the person who wants to rent it, the twain may have not met.
Right.
Never the twain shall meet in this situation. Well, we are coming up to the top of the hour. And Diana in Gladstone, Michigan, I hope you can hang around through our newscast to ask your question relating to a recall on a used camper and who should be responsible. We'll deal with that after we take a look at the news. Michelle Reinen, our guest, and you can call in now or you can send an email right now. The email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Or get online and get in order for the next call right after Diana at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Today on the show, we're learning how to identify scams before we fall for them. We're hearing about others' experiences with scams and how they dealt with them. And our guest today has got lots of good answers. Michelle Reinen, administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, our guest. And if you have a question or a comment or experience to share, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have? Give a call. The number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And now let's go to Diana in Gladstone, Michigan, who's been waiting for a while. Diana, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Hi, Michelle. We bought a used motor home last year, and a part inside caught on fire, and good thing nothing too bad happened. But we did some research, and we found out, even though it's an older camper, that there is a recall that was never done on it, and it was, guess, that part that's in the recall. We called the company of the camper, and they said they bought them out, and that was before they bought them out, and they couldn't do anything to help us. So we do have insurance, but I just wondered if there was anything else we could do.
You certainly could file a complaint with the Michigan Consumer Protection Office to be sure there aren't any state regulations that would cover this situation, and see if they do complaint mediation that would help in any way, shape, or form. But when something is a buyout, it sometimes factors in what that purchase agreement is, if they're keeping a name or a product, what that means for recalls, and what efforts there were in trying to reach people as well. And given it sounds like this is the interior and living part of the motor home, it's different than the drivable aspect of the motorhome, and then U.S. Department of Transportation safety standards that need to be in place and recalls that way. So there's a lot of details to sort through here.
But I bet Michigan's Consumer Protection Division has an 800 number. We don't have it offhand, but I bet you can find that pretty quickly online, Diana. I'd give them a call. I think that's good advice from Michelle here, to give them a call and see what can be done, or if anything can be done. It's kind of too bad.
Yeah, there's going to be some details to sort out on this one.
Yeah. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Darren in Kenosha emailed to say the FDA doesn't regulate supplements or vitamins, so be aware of free trials and offers. To just pay for the shipping and handling, he says what can happen is, maybe he's speaking from experience here, they get your credit card number, and then they will send you stuff and charge you, and they then make it almost impossible to cancel.
Yes, we have heard this over time from consumers. And in Wisconsin, we have an unfair billing regulation that means you can't do opt-out offers. So certainly this would be a situation if someone has a free trial and they have to give their credit card number for shipping and handling, and they then continue on beyond the trial and there wasn't disclosures about canceling 30 days or any of that, that would be a situation. Definitely file a complaint. And if you start getting other product that wasn't part of that subscription that you purchased and they're using that card, definitely something to file a complaint with Consumer Protection about, especially if you're unable to cancel without penalty or a full refund, because those regulations cover those types of situations.
Yeah. Again, the number to file a complaint, 1-800-422-7128, or go to datcap.wi.gov and file a complaint. Mike in La Crosse emailed to say he noticed that several area businesses are informing customers they need to pay a card by card rather than cash. And I've been told that if a customer pays with a debit card, the business cannot charge a fee. Is that true? And if they use a debit card, should the business, and they charge a fee, should the business know this or be informed of it if they're charging a fee for a debit card?
If there's going to be an additional cost for the form of payment, it should be disclosed to the consumer so there is knowledge. And, you know, we're talking about payment here versus going to get a cash advance off of something. So if they are passing any associated fees on to the consumer as part of the transaction, there should be information up front so the consumer can make an informed decision.
Yeah, and
so usually there's a little sign posted at the register. It's what, you know, we see that'll indicate there's a 2%, 3% fee for this versus that.
Yeah, and should it also appear, I can't remember, on the slip, the slip when you purchase.
On the receipt?
On the receipt, I'm sorry.
Yeah, often you're going to see it there as well, yes.
So
but you need to know up front. Well, that's just it. You need to know up front. So it's more important that there be that disclosure, conspicuous information. That's what we're going to be looking for as it relates to consumer protection, is that there is notice to a consumer in advance. So they can make that decision and say, okay, I'm not going to use the debit card. I'm going to use the credit card because there isn't a fee associated with this one. Or, nope, that's the account with the money, so that's the one I got to use.
Mike in Appleton, this is kind of a question for you. What motivates somebody to try and scam another person? I mean, most people, I think, why would you want to do that? I mean, it's for money, I suppose, but...
Yeah, that is the great question, isn't it? If we knew, maybe we could reverse course on some of these individuals. Some of it's money and the other's information because it translates to money. Is it, you know, getting ahead their life circumstances? I will say with the pig butchering scam, which we've talked about over time here on the air, where it's individuals with cryptocurrency and their investment scams, and they try and get you to invest and invest and invest, and it can be an investment coach, an impersonation of an investment coach or a love interest type situation, and they entice you to invest more because look at these great returns. Well, we have seen those types of scams be overseas, and people, young women, are being, They are being held in a room to make these profits and taken advantage of in order to just continue to make profits. So those are crime rings. I mean, when you talk about what motivates a scam, some people who are behind these are just trying to, you know, end up with the reward, air quotes, at the end of the day that they get to sleep on the floor because they're caught up in such a terrible international crime ring. Doesn't excuse the mastermind behind it or who's in control of it. It's just that's some of what we see behind some of these really terrible situations.
Oh, it's awful. Man. Well, travel-related things. If you plan to leave the country on travel next spring or summer, what should you know about obtaining or renewing a passport? Because there's some scams relating to that.
Absolutely. We are seeing online passport services scams out there where you could be applying for or renewing a passport. And you start with, okay, how do I do this? Simple internet search, right? And the problem is those top results could lead to that website that looks official, but it's not where you belong because scammers are buying their way to the top of those returns, or they could be private companies that are offering to provide services for a charge that you can get for free yourself. And they're not doing anything additional for you. They're not getting you to the front of the line. They're just really being a middleman and charging extra fees. These websites often use official names, flags, government seals. They claim they have that special relationship with the government, but there isn't one. So if you're in this situation where it's passport time, either new or renewal, it's travel.state.gov. That's where you need to go in order to get your free application. There is a fee for filing it, for submitting it, and all of that. But then there's the TSA pre-check scams that we're seeing out there. Yep. And I imagine it'll be global entry as well, you know, that we'll see. But TSA pre-check scams where travelers are trying to speed up their airport experience and get through quicker. Well, we are seeing where there are emails and text messages being sent that and online ads posted as well offering to enroll or renew users in TSA PreCheck. And when you click this link, they're taken to a scam website that's, again, designed to steal that money and that personal information. And you may not even realize that you are paying a scammer instead of actually doing your first application or renewal. So what you need to know here is that users applying for TSA PreCheck for the first time, don't pay the application fee online. You can't. You have to go in person, complete the application, pay in person at an actual TSA enrollment center. I know I've seen some pop-up enrollment centers here in the Dane County area at the airport. Different airports have them. Otherwise, they could be at particular business locations that are listed on the tsa.gov/precheck website. But only scammers are going to tell you that you can get a new application and have to pay online. But then there's the renewals. Again, this can be paid either in person or online, but scammers are going to try and get in the middle. You need to be sure you're at tsa.gov/precheck when you're doing your renewals.
And how often do you have to do those renewals?
I believe it's 5 years.
Five years.
I believe the TSA PreCheck and the Global Entry are both 5 years.
Okay. And if you have the Global Entry, does that cover the the TSA?
Funny you're asking this. I've just recently been looking at it, Larry, for my own personal reasons. What I understand, no expert, not claiming that this is not my area of expertise, these particulars, but that if you have Global Entry, it is also like TSA PreCheck, but TSA PreCheck is not Global Entry. So
yeah. the Global is covers that both. But
yeah, getting in. So they say you should be a more frequent international traveler and it will cut it down. But if, you know, you're a once a year, then maybe standing in line's not so bad. Probably depends on your connection time, right? You know?
Well, here we've got, I'm sure you probably haven't received any Valentine's cards yet, but it's coming up in a week or so, week and a half or wherever it is. Valentine's Day is coming, and you might want to order your special someone a gift from a local business, and even here you can get online scammers involved.
You can. This is what we refer to as our geographical misrepresentations. There's a fancy term for everybody, but this is when scammers are, not always just scammers, but some businesses that misrepresentation, they're trying to entice online shoppers to do business with them, and they know people want to do business with local companies for certain things, like flowers and candy and yummy food goods type situation. And so they often will put that community's name, you know, Madison Flower Company, you know, but really they're not here. There's nothing about them. And they will use that representation to entice people to do business with them. Well, all they do is they go to the local, they charge the consumer, they go to the local shop in online and order the flowers. They keep half the money just for placing the order. But now you haven't done business with the true local company. So if there's a problem with the delivery or a problem with the product, you're following up with that company you think is local and isn't. And that local company isn't truly getting the advantage of what you've purchased and put your money investment into. And you may have ended up paying more at the end of the day. And so ways to get around this or to really search this out is run an internet search for the company that you're looking at doing business with and check for local reviews. Really look at the comments and the experience, but then call the company and ask what their hours of operation are, where they're located. When can you go in and see their products? They don't need to know that you're in Arizona and trying to get your mom flowers. You know, they don't have to know, but you can just find out when the store's open. And if they can't answer that and they can't give you a valid address, you know they're not really there and in the community. But we see this with Valentine's Day. We see this with garage door openers and locksmiths that are really just then subcontracting out to the true local company there.
Well, data breaches. We haven't talked about data breaches yet. Companies that suffer data breaches are often in the news. Sometimes customers sue these companies for failing to keep the information secure. But customers are often asked to join class action lawsuits. But they ought to be wary about that.
Yes, we want, because the more and more data breaches there are and the larger and larger they are, the more and more we're going to see scammers taking advantage of this situation. So there are legitimate class action lawsuits out there where a consumer might receive part of a settlement or be notified through official channels. But then there's scammers trying to trick consumers into giving out that personal information by sending these notices of these non-existent class actions, or they're providing fake sign-up details about real class actions. And so then the consumer completely misses out. But a real class action notice, it's going to contain detailed information about the lawsuit. It'll have a description of who's affected, instructions on how you can either sign up or opt out or file your own suit. And it'll have contact information as to the claim, the official website and a phone number for who's administering the case. And a scammer knows this. So they're going to do one of two things. They're either going to send a fake letter or email or even post online ads about the class action suit, and they're going to give vague and sensational details. We've talked about that throughout today. They'll have typos and poor grammar, and they'll request these upfront fees. Upfront fees. Notice I didn't say that with the legitimate one. They'll ask for this upfront money as part of this, and they'll give you fake links and information. Or the other side, they're going to give a fake notice and not include the contact information, the official website and specific information on who's eligible. And they'll give you fake information. And if it's well-crafted, it's going to be really hard to tell, is this legitimate or not? So again, you're going to have to do your research if you're considering this by verifying that a case really even exists, doing that internet search to see if a case really exists, and then confirm who's the true law firm that's behind this case, what's their contact information, and how does that compare to any letter or notice or ad that you have out there, so you can then decide, do you want to be involved in this or not? But the key is, don't pay anything up front. A class action lawsuit, you don't pay up front. The law firm's making their money off the class action settlement.
And plenty of money they're making.
Usually plenty of money.
And I want to go to the credit report, negative credit reports. I know somebody who was going to get a credit card at a electronics company, and they refused him. And he said, well, I've got an 800. My rating is like 800. And they said, no, it's 600 and something. And it was apparently his ex-wife had borrowed money and that got lopped into his as well.
Yeah. Well, yes, consumers with negative information on their credit report, they probably want to try and get that fixed so they can get on the path to improving their score there. And they might want help in trying to fix this. And there's plenty of things consumers can do for themselves for free to do that. But there are also credit repair companies that charge to do the same things. So if anyone's considering an actual company to help them with this, they should know the rules that these companies need to follow, because that way they can evaluate them. If they're following the rules, that might be a good one to go with. And if they're not following the rules, maybe they're a scammer. Credit repair company has to provide a detailed contract that explains that total cost of the service and the consumer's legal rights, like a 3-day right to cancel before they do any work. They have to be honest about the work that they're going to do. And they never remove true information, that's up-to-date information, even if it's negative, from a credit report, because it's valid, it's true. But a scammer is often going to be asked to be paid up front before they do anything. They're going to tell the consumer not to actually contact the credit bureaus directly. And they're going to suggest disputing that accurate information, lying on applications, or filing false identity theft reports. And know that if you work with a scammer that's telling you to do that, or if you see an online influencer that is telling you to improve your credit by filing a false identity theft report about debt that you owe, that's fraud. And that's a crime that can make things even worse for your own credit report. So don't go down that path. again, if you want to try and fix things on your own, check your credit report regularly. You can do that once a week for free online. And that's at annualcreditreport.com. So annualcreditreport.com.
Annualcreditreport.com. You know, coming up, we're going to be talking with our next guest, Carol Tron, and she's going to be talking about how defaulting on student loans can also hurt your credit score. And we're certainly going to be talking about defaulting on that. And you happen to know Carol Tron pretty well.
Yeah, I do. I sit with her on the Wisconsin Coalition of Student Debt Board. And, you know, she's going to have some great information, and it's going to be current information. And that's so important, because scammers make up information and they try and play on people's sensitivity to changing information. And right now we're in a space where all this is changing a lot for student loan debt. So just really remember what I said a number of times today. Don't pay up front. That's going to be true for this if you try and get someone to help you. Don't pay up front. Don't give your FSA ID number. Those things are scams. And she's going to tell you all the true information to help navigate the space.
In the meantime, Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure. You'll be back in a couple of months. We'll do it all over again.
That sounds great.
Michelle Reinen is administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protections. Great to have her with us. And she will be back in a couple of months and do it again. But coming up in the next minute or two, we have got our next guest, Carol Tron from the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. I'm Larry Mueller. As of last fall, some 74,000 student loan borrowers in Wisconsin had fallen behind on their payments. And since then, the U.S. Department of Education has announced student loan borrowers in default could see their wages garnished. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about the status of that and what are the options that are available to these college folks with graduates, maybe with student loans. Carol Tron, our guest. Carol is executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt, and Michelle was just saying, she has the up-to-date information for us, and so you're going to get some real accurate and helpful information. If you're having trouble paying off student loans, which, you know, there's, 11 or 12% of the people in the state of Wisconsin, so over 700,000, isn't it, Carol?
That's right.
That have loans.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, here we are, 10% of the thereabouts or more. And then 10% of that group,
correct,
is in arrears.
Yep.
So I hope, as you're listening to Carol talk, I hope you'll join in with your own questions, or maybe you've got an experience, special thing you want to talk about relating to this. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Carol, thanks a lot for joining us. You lead the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. Tell us about that organization.
Sure, and thank you for having me on the show today. So if you haven't heard of our organization, it may be because we have been around for about 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we started initially as just a very informal but concerned group of different kinds of stakeholders, seeing the news, seeing reports of student loan debt that was really becoming unaffordable for too many in Wisconsin and elsewhere. So our coalition is, we are a nonprofit organization. We are nonpartisan. We focus on providing solutions and resources that that people can act on and address their concerns about their debt. So we have state agencies who are part of our coalition. We have nonprofit organizations, colleges, universities, community organizations, and so forth. And so we share the mission of providing that information, resources free. For anyone in Wisconsin, we provide resources for people before, during, and after the college journey.
I was on your website before the show, and it's an impressive list of cooperators that you have there.
Yes, and again, we're pulling together because I think that that all of us, all of your listeners, can probably think of at least one story or two about their own experiences, trying to figure out where to get help. You just heard an entire program from our amazing board member, Michelle Reinen, just before this, talking about all the scams out there. And so people are really struggling to find reliable and accurate help, and that's why we exist.
You know, let's give the number now. We'll give it again a few times during the show, but that number for free help and advice on student loans and accurate advice.
Correct. So we have a helpline, and that number is 833-589-0750. And that is staffed from Monday to Friday, 8 to 4:30. And I want to emphasize that if and when you choose to call that number, you're going to talk to a live person. You're going to have virtually no wait. So we are not a loan servicer. However, through generous support from Ascendium Education Group, which is also a coalition partner, this helpline is staffed by loan professionals. They're experts, and they'll help you navigate. And the information is not only accurate, up to date, it's confidential. We don't put you in a list. It's free. You can call as many times as you want.
That's a really, really, really good service. Is Wisconsin, I'm wondering about student loan debt. I mean, are we kind of average for, I mean, here we are, 10% of the people who have loans, roughly, or maybe 12%, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
So of those, is it pretty common for?
That's an excellent question. So in Wisconsin, we are a little bit lower than average. Nationally. So we're a little bit lower than average in terms of Wisconsinites who hold 2 or 4 year degrees.
And so then you might, it might make sense that we also are a little bit lower than average in terms of how many of those students take on debt and what the amount of that debt is. So nationally, it's closer to about 39,000. And here in Wisconsin, it's about 32,000.
I mean, there are probably some obvious reasons, but why are so many people struggling to pay back these college loans? I mean, what conditions created it?
Yeah. It's an excellent question. And we know that, through our talking to borrowers and people in the state, we hear a lot of different stories about why it's happened. I do want to say that one thing that maybe complicates the answer is tuition costs have actually stayed relatively stable when factoring in, inflation. It's everything else that's hitting all of us. And so it's things like housing has gone way up. Food has gone up. Transportation costs. At least for public universities, the amount of state support is also lower. Than it was maybe when I went to college. The federal support that students can get, things like the Pell Grant, have not kept up with inflation. And so there's just a bigger gap that students have to fill to be able to go to college and get those degrees.
When I was an undergraduate, I had a $1,000 loan from it was a national defense loan. And somewhere along the line, I got a letter saying that they had some extra money, so they were forgiving a percentage of the loans based on people's GPA. And I was in the high enough GPA that I was forgiven.
Well done, Larry.
That's not going to happen now. And as a matter of fact, the Department of Education announced that, U.S. Department of Education announced that it could soon be garnishing the wages of borrowers in default. Is that, they said it, so I suppose it's true. So when could that start happening?
Well, they actually had announced that it was going to start, and then they postponed. They delayed enacting that, and they announced that mid-January. But things for folks to know is that so something that is pretty unprecedented in terms of why things are so confusing right now is that during the pandemic, one of the many things that the federal government did to help ease the challenges for folks is they put a payment pause for about 3 years. And so that payment pause, so no one owed anything, right? No one was in default. No one was behind. That ended in October of 2023. There was an additional, though, on-ramp period of 12 months, which meant, hey, your loans are due, but there will not be the same kinds of penalties that there normally are for non-payment. Well, all of that is gone. So really, you can find a pretty exhaustive list if you go to studentaid.gov of the consequences of not paying your student loans. But for many borrowers, this number that you shared earlier about the percentage, 10% in default, I'd say a good part of that, at least from the conversations we have, is people not knowing the status of their loans, not understanding are they in forbearance, are they not in forbearance, what loan program are they in, a lot of this confusion is not the borrower's fault. There have been changes to repayment plans. There have been, pauses, restarts. There are since 2024, now we have a new federal administration, different priorities. And so all of those things have created confusing messages.
Darren sent an email wondering if Earnest.com is a reputable company through which to refinance a loan. And that brings up a whole area of things we can talk about.
Sure. There. Yeah. So first thing I'll just say is that as a nonprofit, we're not a financial advisor. So I won't weigh into the merits of Earnest as a reputable or not. What I will say is that something for Darren and your listeners to note is that odds are what they have right now are federal loans. And, you know, something like 91% of student loan borrowing is done through the federal government, not private. If you refinance and you refinance into a private loan, you're going to lose the flexibilities that a federal loan provides. So things like income-based repayment, things like potential forbearance with, you know, if you hit a financial hardship, things like loan consolidation, things like loan forgiveness. And so while you may find that a private loan that you are thinking about refinancing into has a lower interest rate, just be very aware that if you do that, now you are in the private loan market and the terms of your loan will be subject to the lender and that and will not have the same federal flexibilities.
So you need to compare.
You do.
The
correct.
Federal against Earnest or anybody else who is where you could possibly refinance.
Right. Yep.
So, you know, we have this settlement lawsuit. It was brought about by the Education Department to end the Biden-era repayment plan, which was called what? Save or something?
Save.
Like that?
Yep. Saving on a valuable education.
So if you're signed up for the Save repayment plan, and it's set to, It's ended, right? Or is it?
See, this is the confusion that is so hard. So has it ended? Well, there was an agreement that that was reached December 9th. And we can backtrack even further. There have been court actions from certain states who said this is an overreach. Save isn't a legal plan, right? This isn't an appropriate plan. So it's been in limbo since 2023, and it just keeps getting deferred, relitigated, so forth. So is SAVE done? You can't get into SAVE anymore. You haven't been able to since the court cases. If you are in SAVE, and there's several million of us who are, you're being encouraged to move into a different plan. Everyone is going to have to move into a different plan no later than 2028. And depending on when this proposal is accepted, that date may be earlier.
And well, a new plan, could that be a new government plan then? Or
yes, it will be. So what we have that's also intersecting with all of this, you know, fast-moving landscape is the One Big Beautiful Bill that was passed, signed last July, included a lot of really significant changes. So both in the loan repayment programs and then in the kinds of loans and the amounts that people will be able to take out moving forward. So that passed with that law, we are going to see the existing loan programs consolidated into what is called the RAP program. So the Repayment Assistance Program will be what replaces any of the other income-driven repayment plans. And then there's always the standard repayment plan, which has always been in place.
Carol Trone, our guest today, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. We're talking about the student loan program, and about 10% of the people who have student loans here in Wisconsin are in arrears, and there are others that may be paying off and not having a problem, but could have a problem down the road, and there's plenty of confusion. Love to hear your own experience or questions relating to this. You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at student loan programs in this country, lots of folks are, 10% of the people who have a student loan are in arrears here in Wisconsin, and even higher in other states. And Carol Trone from the Wisconsin Coalition of Student Debt has the up-to-date answers on what's going on with the program. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Someone's wondering, there's a public service loan program forgiveness. And I was thinking back to my, that was a long time ago when I went, was a sophomore or so in college. But is there a forgiveness loan? And if there is, who's eligible for it?
Great question. So first of all, public service loan forgiveness, PSLF, is still very much alive. And something that we like to help people try to distinguish is that there are repayment plans that have come through different regulation. Mm-hmm. PSLF came through an act of Congress, and so it sits on much firmer ground. So it would take Congress to repeal it. With all the news, all the executive orders, all the, you know, the flurry of things that are coming out, we hear a lot of we hear from a lot of borrowers who ask exactly that question. Is it still around? Can I still get it? What's happening to it? So there, if you call our helpline, and I should add, actually, if you're, you know, busy during the, you know, the workday, you can also email us at questions@debtsmarts.org. And we also, you know, provide loan, you know, guidance. But so, you know, one thing to know is that if you are in, if you work for a qualifying employer. So that's another question that we hear a lot. Yeah. Is like, well, what, you know, how do I know, you know, I do this, I do that. It's actually based on who your employer is. You can go on the studentaid.gov website, and there's a whole page, actually many pages, that talk about PSLF. And one of them, you can just plug in your employer name. If you know their EIN, even better, mm-hmm. and it'll show you if they're eligible. And so it's basically 501c3 nonprofit organizations. It is working for government.
Education,
right. So teachers, healthcare providers. And, you know, I think more people are eligible for it than may realize. And the program, you know, was signed into law in 2007 under George W. Bush. And the rules are that you have to make payments for 10 years. You have to make 120 qualifying payments. Now, they don't have to be consecutive. There can be gaps. But 120 qualifying payments. So it took a decade for people to actually then qualify. Mm-hmm. And it was really off to a bumpy start. There was, you know, so, you know, your listeners may have, you know, read about reports that initially very, very few of these applicants were, you know, getting approved. That has changed quite a bit. So we always encourage borrowers who, you know, who are calling in or emailing us that if they think that they may be eligible for PSLF, that they, you know, we will refer them to the studentaid.gov website, make sure that they've got a qualifying employment. You have to work full time. And it's the number of payments, 120 payments. It's not how much you pay. So
it's 120 payments.
Right. And so nationally, I know that those who have qualified for the forgiveness will get forgiven on average about $60,000. So
wow.
So it is worth your effort to look into that if that is your case and you work in public service.
Veronica in McFarland actually has something relating to that PSLF. Veronica, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So I luckily have been certifying my employment. I have two different employers that both qualify. I have my accounts that are doing everything fine. And I realized over a couple years after certifying, there was a large chunk of time that wasn't showing up in my loan count. Come to find out, there's actually an error in, I'm assuming, the reporting of when my loans were very first owned by Direct Loan Servicing, that somehow something didn't get recorded properly. is actually the date that they were transferred to, I think it was Ed Financial, which again happened behind the scenes. I didn't initiate that anything. I have paperwork that says my initial date is correct. And I've been trying to get this changed because what's happened is that I have about 55 payments that are not listed on my PSLF counter at all. My certification for that same employer goes through, again, starting the date that they have for, again, when that loan was transferred.
So what would, it sounds like Veronica would be, it'd be useful for her to call your number.
She can certainly call and talk through that situation. First of all, I want to commend Veronica for being so on top of the record keeping of what she has paid, making sure that she has gotten her qualifying employer to submit the certification each year. You don't have to wait. In fact, you shouldn't wait until the end of the 120 payments. Unfortunately, what Veronica is sharing is not a unique situation, and persistence on her part is going to be key. So sharing that documentation and whoever her loan servicer is, contacting them, making sure that they update and reflect the payments that she has made and that she has proof of. So this is happening, as I was mentioning, there's been lots of shifts in the federal loan portfolio, and many borrowers are hitting this. However, with your documentation and persistence, so for someone like Veronica, if she has actually, once they catch up on the 55 missing payments, if she's at 120, what she should do is continue to make the payments so that she's not listed as being delinquent. And then any overpayment will be refunded to her. She'd like to not make those payments, but she definitely should make those while she is calling her loan servicer, making sure that their records are updated.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, boy, this time has flown. We got about a minute to go here. What should people do?
Yeah. So, I guess I want to leave a few parting words of advice and maybe comfort is that, first of all, if you are in that situation of being confused about your loans, I had student loans myself. Thankfully, I paid them off, but they were confusing. So if that's you, don't feel ashamed. Don't avoid it. You can call us. You are not alone in that confusion. There's been a lot of changes. We're here to help you figure out what do you owe? Who is your servicer? How can you figure out the best loan repayment plan to be in? We do know from national surveys that borrowers do want to repay their loans. We know that it's not people shirking the responsibility. So the issue is how to do it and where to get reliable help. And that's where we are who we are.
And the number to call, it's an 800 number, 833-589-0750. Carol, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Maybe we can do this again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Get update as things go along. Carol Trone, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. And go online as well and take a look at the information they have on their website. And I thank you very much for calling today and for listening. This and all our shows are a team effort. We got Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. We've got Joel Patnaud and Clara Neipert. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.